music that accompanied their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, on their procession down the aisle of Westminster Abbey in the closing stages of their royal wedding. That was Walton's March, Crown Imperial. Commissioned by the BBC, originally intended for the coronation of Edward VIII, used instead for George VI's coronation in 1937. George VI, the father of our present Queen, and 75 years on in the year of her Diamond Jubilee, a perfect way to end the first half of this prom, which has been a glorious showcase for the National Youth Wind Orchestra of Great Britain under conductor James Gourlay. And James Gourlay, quick to point up to the organ loft where Daniel Malt was seated at the Henry Willis organ. James Gourlay making his way back to the front of the platform. The National Youth Wind Orchestra of Great Britain was formed in 1968, and if listening to that has inspired you to get involved, auditions are held every autumn across the UK. Concerts are given at Easter and in the summer after each 10-day residential course. And as well as working with top-class conductors, the young players also get a chance to work on new commissions with composers. So, all in all, a fantastic experience. James Gourlay grinning and gesturing to the young people surrounding him. He's a tuba player. He started playing when he was 10 and was appointed principal at the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra when he was only 18. He's recorded 5 solo CDs, most recently a disc of British tuba concertos. And he's also general director of Pittsburgh's River City Brass, which is the world's only full-time professional brass band. Well, in the second half of the prom, wind gives way to brass with the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. That little burst of applause is for the leader of the National Youth Wind Orchestra, Thomas Melbourne, just threading his way off the stage. During the interval, I'm going to be talking to one of the UK's best-known trumpeters, Alison Balsam, and the composer John Pickard, whose piece Wildfire is going to receive its first proms performance. But I'm delighted to say that I've been joined first by Gavin Higgins, the young composer whose Aufstand received its world premiere on this stage just 20 minutes ago. Now, Gavin, your piece was a response to the riots last summer, and this summer, London feels like a very different place. I'm interested to know if you think there's been a fundamental change or whether we've just papered over the cracks.
It feels like a very different place. It's interesting, the government refused to do an investigation into why the riots happened. They put it down to just mindless thuggery and thieving, which I suppose to some extent it was. And recently The Guardian and the School of Economics have done their own sort of private investigation into why this happened and how we can prevent it happening again. The interesting thing was, I remember in the news while this was all going on, there was a lot of emphasis on how bad the youth were. It was all children on the streets, kids on the streets. It was the youth who was causing this. And I was sitting at home thinking, this is not right. This is not what... I mean, there's a tiny fraction of youth maybe doing this. The whole riots were started by a 30-year-old anyway. And I thought of, you know, that organisations like the National Youth Band, the National Youth Wind Orchestra, the National Youth Orchestra, all of these incredible organisations that are up and down the country where a lot of youth are doing very, very special things. So have things changed? I don't know.
But you've been able to showcase that very different side of Great Britain's youth.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy watching that piece unfold?
I did. It's probably one of the hardest pieces they've got on their rep today, actually. They've worked really, really hard to bring it off. Music that many of them are completely unfamiliar with, techniques that many of them are unfamiliar with, but yeah, they've worked amazingly hard on that.
And great fun to hear. Well, Gavin Higgins, thank you very much. I know how much the audience here in the hall enjoyed that piece.
Thank you.
John Pickard, you know what it's like to play in a brass band. Tell me about your formative musical experiences.
Well, I only started playing in a brass band really quite late on. I was in my mid-teens. I started out as a pianist. I joined a brass band when I was maybe 14 years old, something like that. And that was really through the state education system. There were instruments available to play and free tuition. And it came from there.
What could being in a band offer you that being a solo pianist couldn't?
Oh, involvement with other musicians. And it was very, very important to me because I was already trying to compose. And as soon as I joined a band, I realised that I had to compose with human beings. And it's a big difference. And it's quite interesting, you know, with these two ensembles today, the wind orchestra and the brass band, I understand that about 60 to 70% come from state schools still, which is great news. Although I think certainly in the case of the brass band, the number of performers coming from state schools is going down. More and more of them are coming from independent schools. And that seems to me to be a worrying trend. And I think it says something about the provision of instrumental teaching in state schools in Britain.
But you're certainly trying to raise the profile of brass band music, for example. And we're going to be hearing one of your pieces part two of this from Wildfire. Tell me about it.
Well, the piece is quite an old piece now. I wrote it over 20 years ago. And it was actually my first composition for brass band. I chose the medium. I wasn't asked to do it. I asked to... there was a commission I could write for whatever I wanted, and so I chose to write for the National Youth Band of Wales. And subsequently this piece became part of a much larger work, a piece called the Gaia Symphony, which is a 60-minute work for brass band. Each movement is based on one of the four classical elements. This obviously is the fire piece. It's a pretty virtuoso workout for the band. It's relentless. It's continually fast for about 12 minutes.
So you don't pull your punches, even though it's for young players.
Not a bit. Not a bit. If anything, you can you can test them even more. You see, the thing is with young musicians, it's only hard if you tell them it's hard. If they don't know it's difficult, then it doesn't matter, they'll play it.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to hearing that in not too long a time. But we're going to look a little bit further ahead now towards a prom happening later this week on Wednesday evening. Marin Alsop is going to bring the São Paulo Symphony Orchestra here all the way from Brazil for the very first time. And there's a programme that includes works from North and South America. Let's hear from a couple of those players.
My name is Irina Kodin. I'm Bulgarian. I play the violin for the São Paulo Symphony Orchestra.
I'm Gilberto Siqueira. I'm a principal trumpet, and I'm here for the last 39 years already, and it has been a pleasure to do this all these years.
The orchestra is a big symphony orchestra, and what is most curious about it is that it has many different nationalities in it. We have people from around the world, from Korea, England, United States, from Eastern Europe as well, Russians, Romanians. So it's a very interesting mixture of cultures. It will be the first time that a Brazilian orchestra will play on it. The proms, it's really very exciting for everyone. We are really counting the days.
We are playing some Villa-Lobos. We are playing Ginastera as well, as an Argentinian composer. And of course, we are playing some standards. This is a mixture of styles, you know. Nelson Freire, he's going to play a fantasy for piano and orchestra called Momo Precoce. It's a carnival, but carnival of children. That's a very interesting thing. Nelson is an unbelievable person and unbelievable pianist. He's very free, he just plays every time a little bit different. He's not always the same thing, never, never the same. He is a brilliant player, and the relation with the orchestra is quite amazing. I'm very much sure that people is going to like all these concerts. I'm very much sure about that, especially because of the music, yeah. We'll be right back.
two of the players from the São Paulo Symphony Orchestra who'll be appearing, together with pianist Nelson Freire and conductor Marin Alsop, in that prom on Wednesday evening at 7:30. And it features a well-known work for brass and percussion by Aaron Copland, Fanfare for the Common Man, followed by a fanfare for the Uncommon Woman by Joan Tower, her feminist response to Copland's piece dedicated to Marin Alsop. I'm joined now by another uncommon woman, trumpeter Alison Balsam. Alison, brass sections are traditionally associated with beer bar-loving blokes. Did your peers at school find it unusual that you had that choice of instrument?
Well, hello. Not really, because we were all so focused on the music. We were so passionate about what we were doing. It wasn't really that relevant to us. It's more just... you know, it's something for the media to focus on. I'm certain, you know, at this prom this afternoon, none of the young musicians on the stage were thinking about their gender. They were just thinking about being the best artists they could possibly be, and I think that's the most important thing. You know, Copland wrote Fanfare for the Common Man, meaning for everyone, and I think that this response to it is, you know, accentuating that point. It's for everyone, it's not just for a man.
What is it about the trumpet that appealed to you?
Well, I just loved the sound of it from the age of about 7. I had no idea that it might be, you know, more common for a male to play the instrument. Of course, it is an extrovert instrument. It can be very loud and powerful, but it also has tremendous subtlety and great beauty and incredible colour, which we've certainly heard this afternoon, and I'm sure we'll hear in a few minutes. It's so versatile, and I think it's having a real renaissance with today's composers when they realise the scope that it can really cover, and there's none of the instruments have just as one personality. A great instrument has many. It's just the imagination of the performer.
John Pickard, let me bring you in here. Is a trumpet something that you find fun to compose for?
Yes, I do. And having composed a piece for Alison, I know exactly what the trumpet can do. It's enormous variety, because trumpets come in a range of sizes as well. It's not just your standard B-flat or C instrument. There are piccolo instruments, there's a bass trumpet, which is something of a rarity, but a really wonderful instrument. So there are all sorts of things you can do, lots of variety.
Mm. And do you think it's the kind of instrument that appeals to young people in particular? Is there something kind of razzy about it? Is it a sexy instrument?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, it's a very cool instrument. I mean, Miles Davis was the ultimate example of that. But again, it's got so much diversity, it can do so much. It's just really what you put your mind to, really. And as John was saying, you know, it can do many, there are many colours available, you know, with the mutes and the effects and the... as we've just heard, you know, this incredible homogeny of sound where the instruments, when they're playing together en masse, it's just another colour again, which is just something quite unique to Britain. And I think you can, although these players are young, you can hear that unique British sound that you hear in the London Symphony Orchestra. And it's, you know, Britain is world renowned for this particular sound, particularly with brass sections, where they really know how to listen and they know how to blend that sound. And it's, you know, like the brass band culture is so strong in this country, and that's why, because they're so able to play to such a high standard but also listen so carefully at the same time. It's really extraordinary.
I was very interested to see the Aldeburgh World Orchestra, which had players from so many different countries, and yet almost all the brass players were British.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know about that. I can well imagine that would be the case.
So we're going to have an all-British programme in the second part of the prom. But what are the kind of proms that you're looking forward to, which are coming up in the next week or so?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to tonight's prom, Schoenberg's Gurrenlieder. I'm staying on for that. It's a piece that I absolutely love. It's one of my very favourite pieces. I think I first heard it when I was 13, and I was completely blown away by the piece. And every time I hear it now, I'm still blown away by it. It's scored for vast forces. I mean, the orchestra is far larger than anything that Mahler used orchestrally, but it's done with such delicacy. And interestingly, whilst we're talking about brass and wind instruments, of course, Schoenberg writes for an enormous wind section in that piece, and the kind of unusual colours that he creates from that enormous palette of sound makes it a very special piece. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, we hope everyone will keep tuning in. You're listening to BBC Radio 3 live at the BBC Proms, just past the halfway point in this 2012 season.
when we planned to perform three Vaughan Williams symphonies, we all of us were thinking, well, this is wonderful music, we love it, we would like it to be performed. And of course, at that moment, we weren't thinking, Olympics, and how this amazing feeling of Britishness coming together and the pride of putting on Olympics, and that process you go through of looking at yourselves and saying, well, you know, we have our problems, but we also have things we're very, very proud of. And we didn't stop to think that this was a perfect moment to be listening to Vaughan Williams symphonies, because they do exactly the same. They don't hide from the difficult things. They're very British, or even you'd say very English. Vaughan Williams was a self-confessed very English man and a very English composer, but that's in no way limiting him. He's just saying, I'm using what I know, I'm using my musical roots to explore. And that's what these symphonies do. So I'm hoping even for those people who've never heard these pieces before, that there'll be a sense of, wow, yes, we can be proud of this music and it speaks to us still and we've got something to learn from it.
Andrew Manzi speaking to us last week from the depths of a Swedish forest. He's currently on his way back to the UK to prepare for Thursday's Prama, Feast for Lovers of Vaughan Williams' Music. Symphonies 4, 5 and 6. And John Pickard, that's a Prama I know you're really looking forward to.
Very much so. They're an amazingly contrasted trio of symphonies. I've always thought they would go well in the same programme. They were the fourth and the sixth were written either side of the Second World War, the fifth during it, and the fifth is an extraordinarily peaceful piece, even though it was written at the height of war, and the pieces on either side are apocalyptic. People who associate Vaughan Williams with the Lark Ascending and the pastoral tradition, if they don't know these pieces, they should listen and they'll get a heck of a shock.
Yes, I hope they'll tune in, the fourth especially, isn't it? Bleak, yeah. And extraordinary. Now, Alison, what are you looking forward to in the week ahead?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to mentioning Ulbra, as you did earlier, the Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten, the wonderful British composer, who's just was an absolute master of colour and, you know, evoking that Ulbra scenery. It's really quite extraordinary, and I know it's going to be a fantastic performance from the English National Opera.
Fantastic. Well, before we get to that, we've the second half of this afternoon's Prom featuring the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. Alison, just quickly from you, how important are these kind of organisations for young people?
Oh, I think it's absolutely vital. I mean, there's nothing else really in education that provides what this is providing for these young musicians. You know, the identity of our country, I can't stress how important it is. The identity of our country is it's made by our culture, and the culture is made by the young people and what they're experiencing as they grow up and go through education. The age they are right now, it's, you know, they're learning like sponges. They're completely open-minded and not kind of prejudiced in any way, we hope. And it means that they are going to be such fantastic ambassadors. And of course, you know, it's no mean feat. They're performing one of the most prestigious music festivals in the world, and they deserve to be here, and they're doing a fantastic job, and they're saying something that, you know, none of the other concerts are saying. It's really unique, and I think it's an amazing sort of beacon of what we can achieve in this country, and I think people need to take notice of how extraordinary they are. They're not professional, but they are communicating wonderfully. There's a great atmosphere here in the hall, and I think it's vital to education that this kind of thing can happen.
Alison Balsam and John Pickard, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy part two of the Prom. Before that, in each of our live Sunday intervals, we've been hearing from historian Dr. Lucy Worsley as she scours the area around the Royal Albert Hall for interesting things to see. Today, she's crossed the road and she's heading for Kensington Palace.
This is Kensington Gardens on a sunny afternoon. We've got kids rolling each other down the banks over there, people relaxing in the stripy deck chairs, a bit of cycling, rollerblading going on, a lot of people wandering up and down, and quite a lot of them actually turning in here to what's the grand new front entrance to Kensington Palace, where I work as one of the curators. And since March, it's been all new at Kensington. And because of our alterations, people at last can find the way in. It was really difficult to find before. The person who marks the entrance is a white marble statue of Queen Victoria, placed right outside her childhood home. Kensington is where Victoria was born, grew up, first set eyes on Albert, another key moment in the history of the palace, and it was also here when, aged 18 and 3 weeks, in the bedroom whose window we can see just there, that she was woken up and told that her uncle had died in the night and that she was now the queen, the teen queen. The statue shows her at the age of 18 on her accession, but it was made many, many years later. This statue was created, and this is perhaps the most interesting thing about it, by her daughter, Princess Louise. Now, Princess Louise is just my favourite of all of Victoria's daughters, because she was the royal rebel. She was the least princessy of the lot of them. And although it's going too far to call her a feminist or a radical, she did do some quite unusual things for a princess. For example, she went to art school. She trained as a proper artist. Before, this had always been a sort of nice amateur pastime for princesses, but Louise could have become a professional, probably. She supported women's suffrage. She went to visit the first ever female doctor, Elizabeth Garrett, and she was a big supporter of education for women as well. Now, in some ways, her life was disappointing to her because she got married to a commoner, which was also seen as rather radical and revolutionary at the time. He was the heir to the Duke of Argyll, and he made her go and live in Canada when he became the Governor General of Canada. He wasn't particularly keen on that. They never had any children, as they were fully expected to. And so, you know, her family life was a bit of a disappointment, I think. But instead, she did have creativity. And this, somehow, some of the time, it got her into trouble. For example, her teacher was a sculptor, a professional sculptor, called Joseph Edgar Boehm, and he died. And there was a scandal because she'd been in his studio at the time, and people were saying, what was she doing there? What were they up to? What gave him the heart attack? There was lots of sort of rumours about it, probably all completely untrue. But she did have this reputation as being a bit racy. She would smoke. She would flirt. All the other members of Queen Victoria's court and household loved her because she would liven things up. She would have a little bat chat and scandal exchanged in the evenings. And the other thing that she did that was really quite admirable was that she was tough enough to go to her mother, Queen Victoria, when she was really getting herself into trouble through retiring from the world, withdrawing through her very, very understandable grieving after the death of Albert. But she began to lose popularity really quite seriously and dangerously in the years following by never coming out in public. And Louise was one of the ones who said, Mum, you're not doing your job. You really need to get back to it. And the statue itself was designed by Louise at the invitation of people of Kensington who wanted to do a Golden Jubilee memorial for Queen Victoria. And it's poignant to think that when the statue was opened and unveiled in 1890, by that time Victoria was an old woman, and she was practically as wide as she was tall. This is our image of Queen Victoria, an old lady in black who looks a little bit like a potato. But here, her daughter has shown her in her prime. She's poised, she's elegant, she's beautiful. I believe that she has actually been slightly beautified. And she's holding up her scepter, she's wearing her crown, she's wearing flowing robes, she's sitting on a seat. She's the epitome of the elegant young queen. Today, the statue is protected by a little pond or a lake that we've made around it to stop people from climbing up and onto it. And actually, climbing up was a problem, even at the opening ceremony. Princess Louise thought it'd be fun to get 24 little children along, which must have looked very sweet. But some of the boys did try and climb up and had to be brought down again. And one little girl, she looked at the aged and rather formidable Queen Victoria, thought the old queen was going to take her away, and burst into tears.
Lucy Worsley, who'll be back with another quirky piece of local history next Sunday. Well, welcome back to part two of our prom, combining the talents of the National Youth Wind Orchestra and the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. And the applause and cheers you can hear all around me are for the brass players, now making their way onto the stage. They have the chance to dazzle in more ways than one in part two of the prom, taking away our breath in five pieces designed to really raise the roof. We're going to be giving the first prom's performance of Wildfire, composed in 1991 by John Pickard. Bramwell Tovey conducted the premiere of that piece. He'll be conducting this afternoon too, as a flicker of musical flame turns the Royal Albert Hall into a raging furnace. Then comes the world premiere of a new work by Gavin Bryars, especially commissioned for this year's proms. It's called After the Underworlds and uses the lower instruments only, everything from tenor horns downwards, evoking not only the mythically murky regions of Hades and the River Lethe, but an area of Leeds where the River Aire is diverted through tunnels under the city's railway station. Principal Cornet gave rise to those cheers. He's James Fountain. Having plumbed the depths, the players saw the heights in Altitude by George Benjamin. And the afternoon ends with Blitz by Derek Bourgeois. And to conduct the first piece, Chorale and Variations by Leighton Lucas, here comes Bramwell Tovey, shaking hands with those seated around the front desks of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain.